How do you communicate with someone who has a communication disorder? Today, an interview with Patty Eaves on working with autism. Welcome to the Carlatt Psychiatry Podcast, keeping psychiatry honest since 2003.
I'm Chris Aiken, the editor-in-chief of the Carlatt Psychiatry Report.
And I'm Kelly Newsom, a psychiatric NP and a dedicated reader of every issue. If we believe the numbers, autism is rapidly becoming the new normal. Here's what I mean. In 2000, 1 in 150 had autism. 2006, 1 in 110. 2010, 1 in 68. 2016, 1 in 54. In this month's Carlatt report, we looked at a study that gives a new explanation for that mysterious rise. But whether it's real or not, you'll need to know how to communicate with these patients. And that's not straightforward, because autism is a communication disorder. Patricia, Patty Eaves, is a therapist and autism expert, and in this interview she shares her top tips on working with autism.
I imagine it can be challenging working with autism. What do you find most rewarding in this work?
Certainly the work can be challenging in the sense that you won't see the same progress as quickly as you might with someone without autism. However, often I find that once the skills are learned, it clicks for them. And to see that progress, as long as you can be patient, it's really a profound experience watching that growth, but also seeing that empower them. And I enjoy being creative, and there's lots of opportunities to be creative when you work with people on the spectrum.
Tell us about some of those opportunities to be creative.
Well, certainly being visual is very important because people on the spectrum tend to be visual learners. So finding ways to use visuals, handouts, ways of explaining things in more concrete terms because they tend to be literal and concrete learners. So that's been something that's allowed for creativity. And then also incorporating restricted interests that they may have, which is another feature of autism spectrum disorder, and being able to take something like medieval history and tie that into feelings or things that you're trying to teach them is always fun and allows for a lot of creativity.
I've heard it say that autism is a disorder of social communication. So what are some of the pitfalls that a therapist can run into when communicating with this population?
Yeah, that's absolutely a good question because it is a primary core impairment area when we're looking at autism spectrum disorders. Knowing that they can be a little more literal and concrete is part of that. So when you're explaining information or trying to relay information, it's important to watch that kind of language. So being less ambiguous and less abstract and avoiding things like idioms can be helpful. For example, if I say something like, oh, we'll talk about that down the road, they may go, what road? What road are we going down? What's happening? So, you know, watching that language and being able to explain, oh, no, we will talk about that at a different session. And really having very concrete ways of providing information is really important. So I'm often using cognitive behavioral therapy because by nature it's very structured. That tends to help them. And it also helps them with some of the black and white thinking that's very common with autism spectrum disorder as well.
What kind of thought patterns do people with autism get stuck in?
Black and white thinking can be a big part of that. So it's either one or the other. And so we work in, you know, where are the gray areas? How are there ways that we can be more flexible in thinking about this? Theory of mind is a big challenge for people on the spectrum. So being able to put themselves in another person's perspective, helping them understand where another person might be coming from can be a big part of the therapy too, whether we're talking about a child and just learning basic social skills or friendship skills, or we're talking about an adult who has a partner. And when you're doing that kind of work, I find it's incredibly important not just to teach the skill, but the rationale behind the skill and how that skill then can help them. So how maybe communicating a greeting, although that might seem, you know, they see me, I'm here, that might seem unimportant to them. The person sees me, why would I need to say anything? Explaining to them why that's important and how that helps the friendship. You know, someone, if you want play, a greeting is an important place to start. And this is why. I had an adult client earlier today tell me that understanding intention behind communication was a big help for them in being able to communicate with their wife in a way that helped them express that intention versus being maybe more direct where it came off bossy So explaining that rationale has been a big part of the social skills work as well.
So once they get it, the reason behind all the social conventions you're trying to teach them, the work goes better. Sounds like you're appealing here to their strengths. Isn't reasoning and rational thinking a strength in autism?
Absolutely. And, you know, it's great that you bring up strengths because that's a big part of helping them understand the diagnosis. And although that we're working on these impairments, there are huge benefits to having some of these ways of thinking in different areas, particular jobs they can excel in.
The stereotype is that they do well with science and technology, but are there other jobs they can excel at?
Sometimes a job that requires one to be maybe away from people and it's very repetitive in that way works for them. I've had clients who really enjoy the repetitive nature of bagging groceries. I've had clients who enjoy clerk work at a law office because they're filing and they're doing something that's very repetitive in that way. It depends on the client and their interest and their strengths.
You reminded me there's a wonderful car wash franchise in Florida called Rising Tide. They hire people with autism, and they say it's as good for business as it is for the community.
That's another good point you bring up. Detail-oriented work can be a really, really beneficial job for somebody on the spectrum.
To recap, people with autism don't do as well with ambiguous or abstract information, so we have to speak clearly and directly, with concrete details, maybe even making it visual. And we can't assume that they understand things that we take for granted, like why it makes sense to greet someone socially, or even to go to class in college. So we need to explain the rationale for these changes we're looking for them to make. Here's another dilemma. Our work in psychiatry depends on assessing the patient's internal state, but I understand that people with autism have difficulty expressing that.
Yes. Expressive language can be an impairment. And, you know, also you add in some of the sensory challenges. So they may just not be experiencing feelings in the same way that we would. They may not be able to express it in the same way that we would. And I say we as in someone who's neurotypical. So with children, I tend to do something like a 5-point scale with a lot of affective education. So we'll talk about what does a feeling look like in terms of behaviors along that scale. So maybe we take one feeling like anger and we'll talk about what behaviors can they notice that they're engaging in that can help clue in to where they're at.
What kind of behaviors clue you into their emotional state?
Maybe increased eye contact avoidance. You may see pacing that can happen because that's calming for them. For other clients who may have autism spectrum disorder, you may see some more stimming behavior, which can tell you that they're feeling a little bit more activated.
What is stimming?
Stimming. So stimming behavior is self-stimulating behavior that's calming. So it's different than a tick because it's not involuntary, it's a voluntary behavior. But sometimes you'll see rocking or the typical hand flapping or finger twisting, repetitive movements that tend to be calming for them.
Does it help for them to direct that self-stimulating behavior into more socially acceptable avenues like using a fidget spinner?
Absolutely. I recommend fidgets to many of my clients. And I have some clients who will take small fidgets they can keep in their pocket to work. So when they're feeling a bit more overwhelmed and they can't step away to take a break, they can use that to fidget with.
I understand that people with autism have trouble reading body language. How do you adjust your own body language to accommodate that?
They can have trouble reading facial expressions accurately in body language. They may think that if I laugh, that I'm laughing at them, or they may think I'm angry. So being able to verbalize the feeling and be very clear about that can not only help them understand feelings themselves, but help them understand what's going on with my internal state. You know, many of my clients will say, are you laughing at me? Are you mad? Are you mad at me? And being able to have that open conversation, say, you know, explain that.
It sounds like they're not completely blind to nonverbal communication. They just have trouble reading it and often misread it.
Correct. I would say, you know, again, there's levels of severity in impairment, but for the most part, the clients that I see in my office are able to recognize, you know, these emotions, but maybe misread it or misinterpret it. Or they're feeling anxious and being activated because of the social interaction. And so attuning to that can be more challenging.
Is it true that people with autism often have a neutral, almost flat affect?
That can be very common, but you can also see facial expressions appearing at times that that's inappropriate for the given situation. You may see kids start laughing at a time where nobody knows why they're laughing. That's more rare. I would say that more commonly I do see people with more flat or restricted range of facial expression. That's something in understanding autism that I'm aware of, and it's not something that I think I rely on to understand their internal state. Some of those other nonverbal behaviors, as I mentioned, of shifting eye contact away more than they would normally be doing, or fidgeting a bit more, or engaging in some of those repetitive behaviors, will be a clue for me that they're feeling more activated. And I'll watch for their breathing as well to look for some of that typical activation we may see in anybody with their nervous system.
You mentioned earlier that you rely on things like pacing or fidgeting to read their emotions. And I'm guessing that it's hard to read their facial expressions, which often are flat or neutral. And that in itself can be disconcerting, because we naturally might misread a flat facial expression as angry or disinterested. Have you had to overcome your own natural reflexive reactions in working with this population?
Yeah, I mean, I think that that's something I've naturally adapted to. You know, it's become almost instinctual and not something I think about actively. So trying to describe specifically how I would deal with that is a little bit more challenging. It's something I've just accept as who they are, and I know that they're not angry and often feeling anxious. It's usually the emotion that's present, and helping them feel comfortable and safe is the key part of that.
It sounds like a therapist needs a good theory of mind themselves to work with autism.
Certainly. Yes, absolutely.
I wish our audience could see you, Patty, because you are very expressive. You have a big, warm smile as you talk. You wear your heart on your sleeve, and it's easy for me to read your emotions. Is that something you've developed to make it easier for your clients to read you?
That is an excellent point. You know, I had never thought about that, but I've often been told my face is quite expressive, and I do think having a pretty clear, expressive face does help them because it makes it much more obvious to them. And my voice tone, I'll be more deliberate, and it's not something I'm consciously doing, but I do try to emote to help them understand where we are. And I use a lot of irreverent humor with them as well. And they tend to respond well to that, you know, and we'll just be maybe a little silly or use some humor in the therapy. And that really helps with rapport, and it helps bring that anxiety down a little bit too.
So you aim to be very direct, genuine, and authentic with your clients. And I've also heard that being very direct and very honest is a strength in autism.
Absolutely. The honesty is one of my favorite things about working with people on the spectrum. They're going to tell you what they're thinking and feeling in very clear, honest ways. Sometimes it may not be something you want to hear, so be prepared for that. You know, may say, hey, I don't like your sweater. And we say, okay, you know, that's fine. Let's talk about how that might make someone feel and how do we express some of these things in appropriate ways. But, you know, the authenticity is really important, and they are generally speaking very honest and authentic themselves. And I think that's a huge strength, although it can be challenging in social relationships. So just trying to use those powers for good is part of that goal.
Is humor also a strength?
Absolutely. Humor and you making sure that it's appropriate. I mean, just sort of guiding it in the right direction.
What advice do you have for psychiatrists working with people with autism?
Learning how folks on the spectrum learn and think is important. So I highly recommend the TEACH book, or the TEACCH book, which goes through a lot of how people on the spectrum tend to process and think and learn. Patient and kind, and use visuals when you can, give handouts when you can, be clear and concise, and check for understanding.
How do you explain the autism diagnosis?
I explain autism as a diagnosis that is not one that has a cure, but I also emphasize that it's a small part of who they are and it does not define them. And so identifying their strengths in addition to describing the diagnosis is important. I generally will visually incorporate that. So maybe with a child, if they have an interest in dinosaurs, I may draw a dinosaur on the board, on a whiteboard, and I will put autism as maybe, you know, just the tail. And then we'll build in the things that they're really good at or strengths of theirs and explain that that's just one small part of who they are. This does not define them. And then I explain the core challenges in social behavior, communication, and restricted interests and repetitive behaviors. Many people still prefer to identify as Asperger's, though that's no longer part of the diagnosis. It's all autism spectrum disorder. But many people, particularly adults, find that that describes their experience with autism spectrum disorder more accurately.
And in the DSM-5 era, where Asperger's is taken out of the book, would we just call that mild autism?
Yeah, we would say that that would be maybe a level 1 impairment. So now we have specifiers that would be a level 1, level 2, or level 3 impairment.
Thank you, Patty.
Patty Eaves holds a master's degree in social work from the University of Michigan, Ann Arbor, and completed postgraduate work at UMichigan's Autism Spectrum Disorders Clinic. She practices in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, and has spent most of her career working with autism. And now for the word of the day, effect size.
These days, more and more papers are reporting their results as effect size, and that's a good thing, because the effect size tells us how powerful a treatment is. Specifically, it tells us how big the difference is between the placebo and the treatment. And here's how to interpret it. A small effect size is between 0 and 0.5. This is what we see with omega-3 fatty acids in depression, 0.3, buspirone in generalized anxiety disorder, around 0.25, and frankly, even most antidepressants fall in this range. They fall around 0.3 to 0.5, which is technically small. A medium effect is 0.5 to 0.8. Here we're talking about the acute effects of antipsychotics in schizophrenia or benzodiazepines in anxiety. A large effect. This is the kind of effect that anyone could pick up on. It could be seen with the naked eye. It should be obvious to you. This is 0.8 and above. Not many psychiatric treatments reach this level. We're talking about stimulants in ADHD and ketamine, TMS, or ECT in depression. There's a lot more to know about effect size, which is also called Cohen's D, or the standard mean difference. Confusing, since these all mean the same thing. And we'll cover it more in a future episode.
Join us next week, where we'll revisit the age-old question, which is the best SSRI?
You can read the full articles and earn CME credits for your work at thecarlattreport.com, where we have a special offer for our podcast listeners. Use the promo code PODCAST, that's all uppercase, and you'll get $30 off your first year's subscription. Your subscription helps us stay free of industry support.
If you like this podcast, share it with someone you know, or give us a rating in the Apple Store. We'd love to hear from you.